Hello, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide for this exploration into the sources.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help unpack the layers of information and analysis you've provided.
Today, we are doing something pretty ambitious. We're aiming for a critical, comprehensive, and really granular analysis of federal activity across all three branches.
Yeah, the goal is to distill a complete report, basically everything significant that's happened federally since the start of Monday, October 27th, 2025.
Exactly. This deep dive is titled The Federal News Update for Tuesday, October 28th, 2025.
And as we were digging through all the sources, you know, the legislative stuff, executive orders, court filings, this really striking pattern just jumped out. It really defines this whole governing moment.
It really does. It feels like we're dealing with two totally different governments running at the same time, often pulling in completely opposite directions, all within the same city.
That's the paradox, isn't it? On one side, you've got this incredible domestic paralysis. We're, what, day 27 now of this government shutdown?
Day 27. And it's debilitating. Total legislative gridlock. And honestly, we're looking at what seems like a deliberately manufactured humanitarian crisis coming to a head this week.
It's a government that, domestically at least, seems to have just stopped working on its most basic function.
Completely. But then you flip the coin.
And you see this really assertive, decisive executive branch. The president's leading it, acting almost completely free from all that domestic mess.
Right. They're on this big Asia tour, signing trade deals, projecting American power globally.
And the financial markets. They love that second part. They're celebrating it. Meanwhile, back home, everyone's bracing for the impact of the first part, the shutdown fallout.
This split, this collision between global action and domestic collapse, it's really coming to a head right now. There are two huge inflection points just in the next, what, 72 hours?
Yeah, these aren't far-off problems. They're immediate. The first one is domestic, and it's maybe the most urgent. Saturday, November 1st.
This coming Saturday.
Right. That's the deadline for two massive crises hitting at once. SNAP benefits run out.
For millions of people.
Exactly. And at the same time, the Affordable Care Act open enrollment starts, which means millions are going to be looking at huge premium hikes if those subsidies aren't there. It's maximum pressure politically.
Okay, so that's the domestic powder keg. What's the second inflection point?
That one takes us overseas. It's global. The president's upcoming meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Ah, right. The big one.
Huge. The outcome there on trade, on stability, that's going to ripple through the entire global economy. It involves the world's most critical bilateral relationship.
So you have the domestic government basically shut down, while the international side of the executive branch is gearing up for arguably its most important diplomatic meeting of the year.
Let's stark contrast.
Okay, let's dive into where the institutional failure and the immediate human cost are most visible. That's the domestic crisis, the legislative paralysis on Capitol Hill, day 27.
And the core problem, the reason for the shutdown, it hasn't budged. It's still these fundamental disagreements over policy, specifically those enhanced health care subsidies for the ACA.
The basic standoff is what? Republicans want a clean funding bill first.
Pretty much. Republicans, especially in the Senate under Majority Leader Thune, are saying, look, we can talk about policy health care, whatever, after the government is reopened. Pass a clean continuing resolution, a CR, first. No policy riders, just fund the government.
And Democrats are saying no way.
Absolutely not. They're insisting any funding bill has to deal with these rising health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
It has to restore those enhanced subsidies that just expired. They see ignoring that massive cost increase for families as just politically untenable, maybe morally, too, for some.
So the shutdown is basically a healthcare fight in disguise.
It's a proxy war over healthcare affordability, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Senate is ground zero for this fight. We saw that play out last week with those failed votes on paying federal workers.
Right, the competing pay bills, that seemed almost symbolic of the dysfunction.
It really was. You had two separate bills trying to guarantee back pay for federal employees, something you'd think everyone would agree on, right?
You would think.
But Senator Ron Johnson had a Republican version. Senator Chris Van Hollen had a Democratic one. Both failed to get 60 votes. Not because senators don't want workers paid, but because neither side wanted the other side to get the political win for their bill.
But we did hear about a potential crack in that. Johnson and Van Hollen trying to find some common ground on pay.
Yeah, sources said on the 27th they were trying to work on some kind of compromise pay bill, sort of outside the usual partisan lines.
Does that mean anything?
Well, even if it doesn't succeed, it shows how much pressure is building. especially for senators from states with lots of federal workers. They're desperate for some way to solve the payroll mess, even if the main funding bill that House CR keeps failing in the Senate. What is it, 12 times now it's failed to break the filibuster?
12 times? Wow, the system just seems exhausted.
It does. And Speaker Mike Johnson's response in the House kind of leaned into that pressure on the Senate.
By sending the House home, basically.
Exactly. He formally called October 27th and November 2nd a district work period. House is out. No votes.
Which puts all the immediate pressure back on the Senate to fix it.
That's the chess move, yeah. Johnson's saying, look, our members are doing important work, talking to constituents back home, reinforcing our position. But the effect is the Senate holds the bag entirely for ending this thing right now.
But that strategy is hitting some resistance from outside Congress, right? The Federal Employee Union.
Oh, absolutely. The American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, they represent something like 800,000 workers. They put out a really strong statement on Monday.
What did they demand?
Simple and urgent. Pass a clean CR, get the government open, and guarantee full back pay immediately. They called the shutdown an avoidable crisis. Basically, open the government first, pay us, then fight over the policy stuff.
That's a lot of pressure, especially on Democrats. Did leaders acknowledge that?
Yeah. Senator Dick Durbin, number two Democrat in the Senate, said publicly that the AFGE statement would carry, you know, considerable weight.
But key Democrats are still holding out, even ones with lots of federal employees in their states.
Right. People like Van Hollen in Maryland, Kane in Virginia states, heavily impacted. They're resisting that call for a clean CR. They feel they're on the right side of the healthcare cost issue, and they're determined to push back against what they call the administration's illegal budget actions.
So for them, keeping the government closed is still the necessary leverage to win the bigger fight over the safety net.
That seems to be the calculation, yes.
Yeah.
Even with the union pressure mounting.
Okay, so from the political deadlock, let's shift to maybe the sharpest point of this crisis right now. The SNAP benefits cliff. This is where political failure turns into, well, a deliberate human cost hitting millions on November 1st.
That's exactly right. Federal funding for SNAP Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It helps feed, what, 42 million Americans? About 1 in 8 people?
42 million, yeah.
That funding is set to just stop on November 1st. And the really critical thing here, the intentional part, is that the administration actively chose not to prevent this.
Right. Explain that. There's a contingency fund, isn't there?
Yes, there is. The USDA has over $5 billion in a fund specifically meant to keep SNAP going during emergencies. Theoretically, they could use that money to cover November benefits, buy some time for Congress.
But they're not going to.
No. On October 24th, USDA sent a formal notice to all the states saying, nope, we're not touching that fund. Their argument is really technical. They say the fund is only for things like natural disasters that mess up local food distribution, not for a funding gap caused by Congress failing to act.
Which sounds convenient. Does that contradict how they've handled shutdowns before?
Well, critics certainly think so. It seems to go against previous USDA guidance, which strongly suggests this is a new interpretation, a policy choice designed to maximize the pain and pressure.
So, using the safety net as a weapon.
That's how Senator Schumer put it. He accused the administration of making an intentional choice to turn SNAP into political leverage. Use the threat of hunger, basically, to force Democrats to cave on the clean CR.
And the states are scrambling.
Oh, completely. They're in crisis mode. We saw concrete examples just yesterday, October 27th. North Carolina warned 1.4 million residents are at risk. Their governor, Josh Stein, called it a cruel advocation.
Wow.
Washington State's agency warned benefits stop after October 31st.
Yeah.
New Hampshire officials were told flat out, November benefits suspended. It's rippling across the country.
And this immediate crisis is happening against the backdrop of longer term changes to SNAP, right? From that big bill passed recently.
Yeah, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
Yeah.
That law already made some major changes to SAP separate from the shutdown fight.
What kind of changes?
Well, for one, it expands the work requirements for able-bodied adults without dependents. The age limit used to be 50, now it goes up to 64.
Which hits older workers who might have trouble finding jobs.
Exactly. It's controversial because folks in that 55-64 age range often face age discrimination, might need retraining, making the work requirement really tough, potentially punitive for them.
And there was something about shifting costs to states, too.
Yes. That's a huge shift. Starting in fiscal year 2028, states could be forced to pay part of the actual SNAP benefit costs, like 5 to 15% if their payment error rates are too high, specifically over 6%.
So states are on the hook financially if they make too many mistakes administering a federal program.
Pretty much. It puts a major potential burden on state budgets. They have to run these complex systems flawlessly, or they could end up paying for federal policy decisions. It federalizes the program but kind of regionalizes the penalty.
So while Congress is gridlocked, the human cost is definitely mounting, especially for the federal workforce itself. They're about to miss a second paycheck.
That's right. You've got roughly 670,000 federal workers furloughed, sitting at home, and another 730,000, think TSA, air traffic controllers, Border Patrol, working without pay.
Over a million people directly affected.
And yeah, they're all going to miss their second full paycheck this week. That's a massive hit, not just to them, but to local economies that rely on those federal salaries.
And military families are feeling this too, right? Even though the administration tried to shield them earlier with that controversial funding move.
Yes, definitely. There were major pay problems around the October 15th mid-month pay cycle. Big discrepancies.
And those haven't been fixed yet.
Not as of October 27th, no. So these families are already behind, financially stressed, and now going into the next pay period, still short from the last one.
Do we have any specifics on those errors?
We do, actually. The National Military Family Association did a survey. It gives a pretty clear picture of the mess. They found 164 families who were significantly underpaid. We're talking $600, $800 on average.
That's a lot for a military family budget.
It is. And even worse, 55 families reported getting zero pay. Nothing, even though their earnings statements showed they were owed money.
Zero pay? How does that even happen?
Bureaucratic chaos, it seems. And then on the flip side, 50 families got overpaid. One family got three times their normal paycheck.
Which they'll have to pay back eventually, adding more stress.
Exactly. It just highlights how vulnerable many of these families are. We know about a quarter of them have less than $500 in savings. So one missed paycheck or even a $700 error
can be a full-blown emergency.
Right. What's maybe a rounding error for the Pentagon is catastrophic for a young enlisted family.
And wasn't there also an issue with PCS moves, people paying out of pocket and not getting reimbursed?
Yes, that's compounding the debt. Families moved over the summer, paid thousands up front for relocation costs, expecting reimbursement checks by early October. Those checks are held up by the shutdown. So now they're paying credit card interest, maybe $200, $400 extra on money the government owes them for expenses they covered months ago.
Which brings us back to how military pay is being funded right now. That controversial decision earlier this month to use R&D money.
Yeah, diverting $8 billion from military research and development funds to cover payroll. That was and is a really big deal. Not just technically illegal under appropriations law, but a major challenge to the separation of powers.
Wow.
Well, legal experts argue the executive branch just doesn't have the authority to do that. Congress specifically set that money aside for R&D, for long-term projects. The White House basically said, nope, we need it for payroll, and took it.
Without congressional approval.
Without any approval. Right. It asserts this power for the president to decide where money goes, even if Congress explicitly directed it elsewhere.
The appropriations king idea.
Exactly. If that stands, if the courts don't slap it down, it's a really dangerous precedent. The president could essentially override Congress's budget decisions based on political priorities, pick and choose which programs get funded during a shutdown, regardless of what the law says.
Okay, so beyond paychecks and these big legal fights, the shutdown's causing real problems with government services too, right? Especially with that November 1st healthcare deadline looming.
Absolutely. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, had to scramble. They brought back furloughed staff on Monday the 27th.
How'd they pay them if there are no appropriations?
They used what are called non-appropriated research user fees. Basically, money collected from private industry for specific research projects, which isn't part of the annual budget fight.
Workaround. Why was that so critical?
Because open enrollment for Medicare and the ACA marketplace starts November 1st. Without those staff, millions of people wouldn't be able to sign up, compare plans, get basic info. The whole system could seize up.
But even with staff back, there were still problems.
Yeah, the main website, healthcare.gov, was still showing old, outdated plan information from 2025 as of Monday.
Seriously, days before open enrollment starts.
Yep, so people couldn't preview their actual 2026 options or see what the new costs would be, which completely undermines the program right when people need that information most, especially with premiums expected to jump. How do you make informed choices?
You can't. What about other essential services? Transportation, security.
Things are getting strained there, too. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy warned publicly that air traffic controllers, working without pay for almost a month now, are getting stretched thin. Wearing thin was his phrase. He said expect major delays, especially at big airports. That obviously raises safety concerns, too.
And security clearances?
The Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, DCSA, they handle clearances for defense contractors and personnel. They're still operating using their working capital fund, another mechanism outside the regular budget. But sources say the shutdown is causing a huge backlog, a real drag on getting essential people cleared and onboarded. That impacts defense readiness, intelligence operations.
And I think I saw something about an FDA glitch, too, adding to the chaos.
Oh, yeah, a massive technical error at the FDA incorrectly marked 7,000 employees as furloughed. Some of those were actually essential staff who were supposed to be working and getting paid eventually. Because of the glitch, they missed pay entirely. Just another layer of administrative failure on top of the political one.
Okay, let's pivot now. Because while all that is happening, the paralysis, the service failures, the executive branch is acting decisively on the world stage. This is that two governments paradox we talked about.
It's really stark, isn't it? President Trump's on this multi-nation tour in Asia, projecting strength, seemingly completely unaffected by the mess back in Washington. The biggest news came from the U.S.-China trade talks happening alongside the ASEAN summit.
The breakthrough announcement.
Right. They announced a framework for a trade deal. The key thing here is it's designed to stop those huge 100% tariffs on some Chinese goods that were set to hit November 1st.
So averting an immediate trade war escalation.
Exactly. And Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent also confirmed this preliminary deal includes a final deal to sell TikTok's U.S. operations.
Finally resolving that.
Apparently so. Selling it to American-led owners. That takes a big national security issue off the table that's been worrying people for years.
And the markets loved this news.
Oh, immediately. U.S. stocks soared on Monday. The Dow, S&P 500, NASDAQ all closed at record highs. It's fascinating the markets cheering this global stability while basically ignoring the domestic instability brewing.
What else happened on the diplomatic front during the tour?
Quite a bit. Trump oversaw the signing of a ceasefire agreement between Thailand and Cambodia, wading into regional conflict resolution. He also repeated he's willing to meet North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Love to meet with him if he'd like to meet, he said, sticking to that personal diplomacy approach.
And he commented on Russia, too.
Yeah, he called Russia's recent test of that nuclear-powered cruise missile not appropriate and told Putin to focus on ending the war in Ukraine. Very assertive tone globally.
Okay, so while the president is busy overseas, what's happening back home with domestic enforcement under the executive branch? Immigration, for example?
The administration is definitely still active there. DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, put out some big numbers on Monday.
What were they claiming?
They announced removals of over 527,000 illegal aliens, as they term it. And they also claimed another 1.6 million people have voluntarily self-deported under their policies.
So over 2 million departures total, according to DHS.
That's their number, yes. And there was a pretty controversial incident involving a journalist.
Sami Hamdi.
Yeah, Sami Hamdi. He's a British journalist, a Muslim political commentator. He was detained by ICE when he landed at San Francisco Airport.
Why?
Well, the Council on American-Islamic Relations immediately said it was retaliation because Hamdi's been very critical of Israel's military actions. An official confirmed he was in ICE custody pending removal.
Wow. So using immigration enforcement against a critic.
That's certainly the accusation. It shows how quickly they can use those tools in politically charged situations, yep, even against international figures.
And presidential directives are still flowing, too, despite the shutdown.
Absolutely. The wheels of the executive branch keep turning on that front. For example, the major disaster declaration for the Leech Lake Band of the Ojibwe in Minnesota. That was signed October 22nd, but officially published in the Federal Register on the 27th.
Why is the publication date important?
Because that's what officially makes nonprofit organizations in that disaster area eligible for SBA disaster loans. It unlocks crucial rebuilding funds that the community desperately needs.
And the president's rhetoric hasn't exactly cooled down either. Talk about a third term.
You know, he definitely stirred that pot again. On Air Force One, asked about term limits, he wouldn't rule out seeking an unconstitutional third term, said he'd love to do it, mentioned his best numbers ever.
But he ruled out the VP loophole.
He did. He called the idea of running as vice president to get around the 22nd Amendment too cute. So, still floating the idea of breaking the ultimate norm, while dismissing a technical workaround.
It sort of mirrors what's physically happening at the White House, doesn't it? The East Wing demolition?
It really does seem symbolic to some. That demolition is ongoing. It wasn't approved by Congress through the usual funding process. It's making way for this huge $300 million ballroom, 90,000 square feet, supposedly modeled on the one at his Turnberry Golf Resort.
And it's being paid for by private donors.
Entirely. Big corporations, tech companies like Microsoft, Meta, Apple are funding it, which of course raises huge pay-to-play concerns. Critics see it as companies buying access and favor. But beyond that, the act of demolishing a historic part of the White House without congressional approval.
It feels like a statement about acting with absolute power, ignoring precedent.
That's exactly how many are interpreting it, a physical manifestation of pushing boundaries.
And beneath these big headlines, the administration is also using its regulatory power, right? Reshaping things through the Federal Register, what came out for today, October 28th.
Yeah, these filings are really important for seeing the long-term strategy. First, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, USTR, is launching a Section 301 investigation into China, specifically looking at whether China is complying with that old Phase 1 trade deal.
Wait, so they announce a framework for a new deal, but simultaneously launch an investigation related to the old deal?
Exactly. It's like a two-front war strategy. Talk nice, make deals on the diplomatic front to keep markets happy. But simultaneously, use this powerful legal tool, Section 301, as a threat. It gives the U.S. leverage. If the talks with Xi go sour, they already have this investigation rolling, which can legally justify future tariffs or penalties.
Okay, that's clever in a way. What else?
A big shift at the Department of Energy, DOE. They put out an interim final rule called the Energy Dominance Financing Amendments.
Sounds pointed.
It is. It basically strips out the old requirements that federal loan guarantees had to help avoid or reduce greenhouse gases.
So federal money that used to push green energy
is now being explicitly redirected to support fossil fuel projects, oil, gas, coal infrastructure. It's using the government's financial power to push a very different energy agenda, aligning with that energy dominance policy goal.
Okay, and one more, consumer protection.
Yeah, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, issued an interpretive rule about the Fair Credit Reporting Act, FCRA.
What does it interpret?
It clarifies that the federal FCRA law basically preempts or overrides most state laws in the same area.
Meaning states like California can't pass their own tougher consumer protection laws for credit reporting?
It significantly limits their ability to do that, yes. It centralizes the authority at the federal level. This creates a more uniform system across the country, which national banks and credit bureaus generally prefer, but it might mean weaker protections overall compared to what some states would want to enact.
All right, let's turn to the judicial branch. Even with the shutdown impacting courts, the Supreme Court has been busy. Some major actions on Monday that will shape law for a long time.
Definitely. The biggest headline was probably granting certiorari, agreeing to hear the case in United States v. Himani.
What's that one about?
It's a direct challenge to a federal law, 18 U.S.C., Section 922 G3. That's the law that says unlawful users of controlled substances, basically, drug users can't possess firearms.
Ah, so it's a Second Amendment case applying that Bruin test.
Exactly. The court has to decide if there's a history and tradition in American law of disarming people simply because they use drugs, even if they haven't committed a violent crime. The government's trying to draw parallels to old laws about disarming, like habitual drunkards or other groups considered dangerous back then.
What are the stakes?
Huge. This law is used all the time in federal prosecutions. A ruling against it could invalidate convictions and fundamentally change gun control efforts nationwide. We probably won't know the outcome until summer 2026.
Okay, what else from the Supreme Court? Something about executive power.
Yes, the administration filed an emergency appeal. They want the Supreme Court to let the president fire Shira Perlmutter. She's the director of the U.S. Copyright Office.
Why is that a Supreme Court issue? Can't the president fire agency heads?
Usually yes, for executive branch agencies. But the Copyright Office is technically part of the Library of Congress, which is under the legislative branch. A lower court already said the president couldn't fire her for that reason.
So this is a separation of powers fight.
Absolutely. The administration is pushing hard to assert control over officials, even outside the traditional executive hierarchy. If they win, it could have big implications for the independence of other agencies, maybe like the FTC or FCC.
Got it. And any news on immigration-related cases?
Yes, some stability there, actually. The court denied an appeal in the H-4 visa work authorization case.
What does that mean?
It means the existing rules stay in place. Spouses of H-1B visa holders, that's nearly 100,000 people, mostly highly skilled women from India who are waiting for green cards, they get to keep their work permits. If the court had taken the case and ruled the other way, it could have forced them all out of their jobs. So, a sigh of relief for them.
Okay, and there's another important case coming up soon. Not directly SCOTUS action yet, but arguments are scheduled about contractors.
Right. Arguments are set for November 3rd in Hensley v. Floor. This is about contractor liability in combat zones. Really important stuff.
What's the background?
It goes back to a suicide bombing at Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan in 2016. A subcontractor employee working for Floor, the big defense contractor, was the bomber. Killed 5 people. Injured 17, including the soldier Hensley, who filed the lawsuit.
And Hensley is suing Floor?
Yes, arguing Floor was negligent in state court, basically failed to provide adequate security. The big legal question for the Supreme Court is, should federal contractors doing military support work be immune from state lawsuits, like the military itself is under the Federal Tort Claims Act's combatant activities exception?
Can contractors be sued when the military itself can't be for the same incident?
That's the core issue. If the court sides with Hensley, it could open the floodgates. Contractors could face lawsuits in state courts all over the country for things that happen in war zones. It could drag sensitive military operations into courtrooms, force depositions. It really challenges a major precedent called Boyle from 1988 that gives contractors significant protection.
Huge implications for how the military uses private contractors, which is a lot.
A massive amount. It could change everything for the defense industry.
Okay, one last area before we wrap up. It connects back to a past crisis, the OPM data breach from 2015. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's kind of unsettling. The Office of Personnel Management, OPM, is ending the government-paid identity protection services for the millions of victims of that huge breach.
Why now?
They say the 10-year legal requirement for the government to provide that protection is expiring. The irony is pretty thick here. That protection contract cost taxpayers $1 billion.
A billion? And how much did it actually help victims?
It only paid out about $162,000 in actual identity theft claims over that whole period. Tiny fraction. Now, the company that provided the service, IDX, is telling people they have to pay out of pocket if they want to keep it.
But wasn't the real danger of that OPM breach something else entirely, not just credit card fraud?
Exactly. Experts have always said the main risk wasn't financial identity theft. It was espionage. The data stolen was incredibly detailed. Security clearance info, family members, health history, fingerprints, static, unchanging data.
Priceless for foreign intelligence agents.
Precisely. Perfect for long-term blackmail, impersonation, targeting people for recruitment. James Lee from the Identity Theft Resource Center pointed out, this data isn't like a stolen credit card number you can cancel. It's permanent.
And the risk is still there, even now.
Absolutely. That data is still out there, still valuable to nation states like China. And now, with advanced AI, the risk is arguably higher. That stolen data can be used to create incredibly convincing deepfakes, highly targeted phishing attacks, sophisticated impersonations on a massive scale. The intelligence threat hasn't expired, even if the government's 10-year protection contract has.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, the chaos, the contradictions from just one day, October 27th, It all seems to point back to that November 1st deadline here domestically.
It really does feel like the gravitational center right now. This Saturday, November 1st, you get this direct collision. First, the SNN app P benefits cliff starts. Real, widespread, deliberately allowed humanitarian pain begins as food aid gets cut off for 42 million people.
Intentionally suspended.
Intentionally suspended. And second, at the exact same time, ACA open enrollment begins. People go to healthcare.gov, assuming the site even works properly, and millions who lost subsidies will see those massive premium increases face-to-face. We're talking average hikes of 30% for silver plans, maybe 114% more in out-of-pocket costs if subsidies aren't restored.
That hits families right in the wallet just before the holidays. Maximum political pain delivered directly.
Precisely. And the signals couldn't be more conflicting. You had the stock market hitting record highs on Monday because of the potential China trade deal, pricing and global stability executive action.
While completely ignoring the domestic situation.
Totally ignoring the very real, tangible risk of domestic institutions failing. The SNN app cut off, the million plus workers not getting paid, the questionable legality of military pay. The market seems to be seriously underpricing the risk of this self-inflicted domestic crisis spiraling.
So this contradiction, global strength, domestic paralysis, maybe it comes down to that Supreme Court case you mentioned, Hensley v. Floor. It touches on this reliance on non-state actors, doesn't it?
It really crystallizes a key tension. What's the right balance between accountability for private actors performing public functions, especially national security functions, and ensuring they can actually do the job effectively?
So looking ahead to that decision, if private contractors, who are essential in modern warfare, doing jobs in dangerous places that require instant decisions, if they suddenly face the risk of being sued under 50 different state laws for actions the military itself would be immune for, what does that actually mean?
It could fundamentally alter the willingness of private companies to take on that critical work. It could make them overly cautious, hesitant in situations demanding immediate action. It challenges the whole public-private partnership that modern defense relies on. That Hensley decision forces us to ask a really tough question. How much legal risk, how much accountability can we impose on these crucial partners before it starts undermining national security itself? Are we prepared for the potential cost of that accountability when lives are literally on the line?
A provocative thought indeed. That seems like a crucial question stemming from all this. Thank you for joining us for this granular deep dive into the federal news of Tuesday, October 28, 2025.
We hope this comprehensive report helps you navigate the conflicting signals and the fundamental paradox of this really extraordinary governing moment we're in.